And away we go. Pull out your ribs if you got them. Let's go. I have lots. Would you like one? Anybody else want one? Who would like a rib? I don't know if you like the barbecue sauce, but... It down my last two. Okay. All right. So if you remember, we've alluded a little bit to the ribs when we were talking about the erectors. Remember that iliocostalis was on the angles of the ribs, longissimus was between the angle and the neck, and so on and so forth, right? So we're going to go through all those parts together here. So ribs, of course, are considered to be the superior part of the trunk. They kind of, you know, the whole rib cage does represent the trunk per se. Its main function, of course, is protection. Now, why ribs? Why not just a solid mass of bone over top of your thorax? It needs to move so you can breathe. Correct. Okay. So, of course, within here, within this rib cage, we find the lungs and the heart and some of the great vessels. And, of course, this configuration of one to the next ribs also gives an extremely large surface area for muscles and ligaments to attach to. Of course, there are 12 ribs, same as there were 12 thoracic vertebra. And, of course, there's 12 on each side, which gives us a total of 24 ribs. Okay, so we can see them here all the way around creating this thoracic cage or this rib cage. So, as usual, we're going to do typical and atypical. So, our typical rib, most of you have one. They are the very, very large ones that you have there, of which I gave them all out. They don't have one now. Great. See if I've got an extra one here somewhere. It's okay. I got diagrams. It's easier for you guys to have them than for me anyways. So, remember that we had some things to remind ourselves with. On thoracic vertebra, there were... facets and demi-facets, correct? Okay. And I did state in those lectures that that superior demi-facet and the articulates with the rib of that number. So if we're looking at the sixth thoracic vertebra and the superior demi-facet, it would be the sixth rib that would attach there. So what is it that attaches on this demi-facet? It is the head. Okay? So it's wedge-shaped and has two facets for articulation with the vertebra, which would make sense, right? You have to have an articulation on a typical thoracic vertebra. You have to have an articulation for both the superior demi-facet of the associated vertebra and the inferior demi-facet of the one above, correct? Right? So it kind of goes like this. So you have a facet here. You have a facet here, right? And this is where, if I were to draw, you know, this vertebra here, it would go like so. Then we would have our disc, and then we would have our associated vertebra here, and we would see that we have an articulation here, an articulation here, okay? So we're saying it's wedge-shaped, has two facets for articulation with the vertebra, and within, between the two is the crest. Okay, so the crest lies between the two facets of this wedge-shaped head. One facet, of course, articulates with the corresponding vertebra, and the other one articulates with the superior. So we've got T5 here and T6. What rib is this? Right, rib 6. Always where it articulates on the superior demi-facet. Okay, always on the superior demi-facet. So we say here, one facet articulates with the corresponding vertebra, and the other one articulates with the superior one. Okay, sorry, this is kind of flat. I didn't realize it. Is that a little bit easier to look at? Okay, sorry about that. Okay. All right. So we can see it here out at this one end here. So when you look at the examples I handed out, I'm just going to borrow this just for a second. It is this area here behind the angle, and most of the heads are falling apart. You know, it's very very fragile, very small. So most of your ribs, probably the head's a bit broken apart. You don't see it well. But just look, you know, when you look at the rib like this, one I have, you have this bump here, which we'll talk about in a bit. But this is the head. This is the part that articulates with the vertebra here, okay? So we can see it right here. Here's the crest in between. We can see here the crest in the drawing. And we have a demi-facet here and here, which, as I showed here, is the articulation with its corresponding rib, or thoracic vertebra, sorry, and the one superior to it, okay? Now, right behind this head is a narrowing that you can see here, and this is called the neck. So there's a bit of a narrow area between the head and the tubercle. I'll say that now. So everybody can see the tubercle on the ribs that I handed out? See there's a bit of a tubercle there, a bump? Right, yes, it's quite obvious on this one, right? You can see it right here. So here's the head, and then we have the tubercle. Between the head and the tubercle is the neck of the rib, okay? Between the head and the tubercle is the neck. And it's you can see it sort of right in this area here, right behind the head, just prior to the tubercle. So, the tubercle. Now, it is found on the posterior surface, and it's where the neck meets the shaft. There are two parts to the tubercle. There is an articular part and a non-articular part. The articular part articulates with where? Where do you think? It's on the screen, right? Okay. Do you remember the facet on the transverse processes? Remember there was a smooth area on towards the tip of the TVP? So the articular part of the tubercle articulates with the facet on the transverse process of the thoracic vertebra. Which one? Its corresponding vertebra. Okay? So in this case, if we put... this is going to be completely out of whack here as a diagram, but if we put the tubercle here, right, we would say then the TVP of 6 articulates here as it heads out. Okay, so it articulates with its associated thoracic vertebra. So that means that it's the superior demi-facet on the associated, and the articular tubercle articulates with the transverse process at its facet, again, of the corresponding vertebra. In this case, it would be the 6th thoracic vertebra. Make sense, everybody? Okay. Hang on. Okay. Who's got one of the long ribs? Long ones. Who's got a long one? So here we are. I'll show you guys a minute. I'll have my back to you for a minute. Here is the thoracic vertebra. Here's the head. Here's the for two transverse processes. And you can see on this side, there's the facet right there, right? You can see the facet on the TVP right there. Okay, see it there? Right? So if I put the rib on, it goes like so. See it there? So it articulates right there, and you can see how it's on the superior demi-facet, but it's going to go on the one above, correct? Sure you can. Okay. So it articulates just like that. Okay. Beep, beep. Yes. And except that it's a good question. They ask, the question was, is it everywhere on the rib cage? Yes, it is, except on those atypical thoracic vertebra where we have a singular facet, which would be T1, T10, 10, 11, and 12. Correct. Right? Correct. Sorry? We're going to learn about this ligament that fits right in there. Yes, partly, yes. You know, I should use the, there's a document projector here I can zoom in on. Okay. All right. So, who said? Who had this? It's like a boomerang. Come back. All right. So, the tubercle is found on the posterior surface. It's found where the neck meets the shaft. So, at the end of the neck, so the neck would be here, the crest is there, the neck is here, the tubercle is there. And there are two parts. The articular part I just showed you, that articulates with the facet on the TVP of the corresponding vertebra. And the other one is called the non-articular part. Again, structure governs function. The non-articular is the attachment for a ligament that attaches here, known as the costo-transverse ligament. What did I say about ligaments? They always tell you exactly where they are. Costo-transverse means it's between costo, the rib, transverse, the transverse process. Okay? So the second part of this tubercle is the non-articular for this costo transverse. And we are going as a whole section here on these articulations of the ligaments as well, which we'll get to. So don't worry, we'll get back to that. So we can see here, here's the articular part of the tubercle here for the TVP. Here is the non-articular part here. You can also see it here in this drawing as well. Okay? The shaft represents the major part of the rib. So kind of the rest of it, if you want to say that for all intents and purposes. We had the head, the neck, the tubercles, and then the whole rest of it is considered the shaft or the body, okay? It is thin, flat, and curved at the costal angle. So we can see there's a curve here, right? And this is considered, the sharp curve here is considered the costal angle. And this is where iliocostalis articulates, okay? Or attaches to, I guess is a better term, right? So that's where we find remember, iliocostalis, longissimus, and spinalis, right? Okay, within. So on the inner surface, we find the costal groove. So if you look at the inner surface of your rib, you're going to see a bit of a groove. Now, I have a pork rib here left over from one of my meals, and I kept it and boiled it, and because I liked it, because it showed, again, the head was here. No, it boiled off because it was more soft tissue in nature. But you can see how big on the pig the tubercle is. It's pretty significant. So head, neck, and tubercle, and this would be a baby back rib. The gnaw marks. Okay. but can you see the groove? Okay, it's pretty significant, right? And you can see it on the inside of yours. There's a bit on the inside edge. There's a bit of a groove there. Why a groove? Because there is the intercostal nerve and intercostal blood vessels that need to get around. So we're in a pretty significantly moving environment here, right? Ribs are always moving up and down. We have muscles that attach here. So in protection of the intercostal nerves and blood vessels, they run within that groove so as to be protected, because they start proximally and they head out distally to innervate or supply blood supply to the muscle as it comes around the rib cage, right? We have a pretty large surface area here that needs to be covered with the innervation of nerves and supplied by blood vessels, right? So it has to come kind of out and around. So this groove allows these to travel through so that they don't get damaged. So we can see, here's the neck, or the head, sorry, with the crest on it and the two demi-facets. We've got the neck here. We have the tubercle and its two parts, the articular part here, the non-articular part here. We have the angle here of the rib, and the whole rest of it is the body or the shaft. And then we can see on the inside here, we have the costal groove, which allows these nerves and these blood vessels to travel out to or back from the intercostal muscles themselves, okay? All right, true ribs. Ribs 1 to 7 are called true ribs, and they are called true because they attach to the sternum anteriorly via their own costal cartilage. So we can see here, right, remember, 1 to 7, we can see number 1 comes around, there's its own costal cartilage, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. But Brian, there's 12 ribs. So there's 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12. So what happens is 1 through 7 have their articulation posteriorly with the head and its corresponding vertebra, right, depending on whether it's a full facet or a demi-facet, right, depending on T1 to T2. And then they come all the way around to find their own costal cartilage, which articulates with the sternum directly. Okay? 8, 9, and sometimes 10 share the costal cartilage with 7 to attach onto where 7 attaches to. So they all kind of come together. So this is why 1 to 7 are called true ribs, because they have their own direct articulation through the costal cartilage with the sternum. Okay? False ribs are 8, 9, and 10, and they're called false because, as I said, their costal cartilage comes up and all kind of meld together to follow the 7th costal cartilage into attached to the sternum. So we say that 8, 9, and 10, their cartilages are joined to the ribs cartilage superiorly, hence they are attached to the costal cartilage of rib 7. So therefore, we can say that 8, 9, and 10 do not directly articulate with the sternum. Again, we can see here, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and then 8, 9, and 10. You can see they all come together to join the costal cartilage of 7 to find its attachment onto the sternum. 11 and 12, we've already talked a little bit about as being floating ribs. They have rudimentary cartilages that end in the posterior abdominal muscles. So they don't come around to the sternum. The tips of these ribs actually are embedded in cartilaginous material within the abdominal muscles. Now here is a 12th rib. And you can see it just buries in. You guys have palpated it, I think, in lab already. Yeah, by now, you've palpated it. So quite often, though, you make the mistake and you palpate 11. If you get out too far, because you can see just how tiny this is, if you, in your palpation, are way out here, you're likely on 11, not 12. So 12 is significantly shorter, so you do have to come in a little bit further to find 12. But ultimately, you can see it just has a single facet on the end, and it attaches in at that basically the pedicle of 12, and then the tip just is embedded into soft tissue, and hence the reason why it's called floating, okay? So they do not have an anterior attachment to either the sternum or the or costal cartilage. They're just in soft tissue, okay? Here we go again. Oh, there it is, behind my feet. All right, so again, here's our true ribs here. False ribs in blue, and then your floating ribs in this kind of green. That's kind of a nice picture to remind yourself sort of where they are. So you can see, you know, how they all kind of share together here, right? 8, 9, and 10 all come together to share with 7. Atypical ribs are 1, 2, 10, 11, and 12. For their some obvious reasons and some others. So let's do rib 1 first. I have a rib 1. And if you think of all the skinny ribs you all have, this is a first rib. Quite a bit broader, quite a bit larger, quite a bit flatter, right? What attaches onto here? Muscles. What muscles attach onto here? Yep, which ones? And? Correct, okay? So you can see that, you know, significantly that's quite a small rib. And think of a rib cage as an inverted cone, with the apex being superior and the base being down below, right? So we start fairly small at the top, and as we move down the rib cage, the ribs get larger and larger and larger, sort of as an upside down cone, right? So one is relatively smaller than the rest, much flatter in nature as compared to those. So it's the most curved and the broadest. Of course, on the superior surface is the scalene tubercle, which separates two grooves. And these two grooves, anteriorly is for the subclavian vein, and posteriorly is for the subclavian artery. One thing to always remember, arteries are always posterior or deeper than veins, right? So I'm going to pass this around. I don't like to mark it, but I may put just a little, maybe got a highlighter because it doesn't go, it's not quite as bad. I'm going to pass this around, and I have highlighted this tubercle, and you will see the two grooves on either side of it. Okay? There you go. Okay, and pass it around. Right, so anteriorly is for the subclavian vein, and posteriorly for the subclavian artery. And then, of course, as we remember, thoracic vertebra number one was also an atypical thoracic vertebra because it had a full facet superiorly and a demi-facet inferiorly. Do you remember that? So because the superior facet was a full facet, that means that the first rib, because the superior articulation is to the corresponding vertebra, right? The first rib has a full articulation with the thoracic one vertebra on that full facet superiorly. So therefore, it has a single facet on its head to articulate with that superior facet on one. Subclavian. Correct. So right beneath the clavicle, you have a very large vein and a very large artery. The vein, for example, is heading down out of the head, so it's draining venous blood from the head and neck, and it comes out over top of the first rib and under the clavicle. Right? The same with the artery. Again, coming out of the great vessel, out of the aorta of the heart, which we'll learn next week in AMP, the subclavian artery comes up under the clavicle and heads over top of rib one to head into the neck area to supply the two carotids, the internal and external carotids. Okay? Right? So this is why I always get a kick, when the movies where somebody takes a bullet here in the shoulder and they're like, they're just in a regular sling the next day. Right, walking around like everything's good, right? A well-placed gunshot wound here, you could bleed out pretty easily. Do everybody remember how centurions in the Roman army, how they used to, like if you were found guilty of something and you had to be put to death? Does anybody know how the Romans killed fellow Romans who did bad things? No, not Braveheart. They would place the centurion on his knees, and they would drive the blade between the neck and the clavicle straight down, severing the subclavian artery and vein into the lung tissue. Ouch, eh? So you can see it here. Here you can see the grooves here and here, and you can see where splenus anterior is here, and then splenus medius is back here. So again, here's your groove for the artery. Here's your groove for the subclavian vein. And then you've got your scalene tubercle there. And of course, the scalene tubercle is where splenus anterior is. So we correspond this drawing here to this drawing here. So we can say that medial scalenes attaches here on the first rib, and anterior scalenes attaches right here on the first rib. And it divides the two grooves here. Okay? Remember I talked about thoracic outlet syndrome last week and how, we've got this sort of this triangle that's represented by anterior medius and these the artery, vein, and there's also in here traveling in this area is also part of the brachial plexus that's heading up to the arm as well. Rib number two, thinner and less curved than one, two times longer than one, but of course it has two facets on its head for articulation with T1 and T2, of course, right? And it has a tubercle on its anterior surface for serratus posterior. And we'll be going to that muscle at some point here, okay? So we can see here is the comparison between one and two. So we can see two here. Of course, this is where we find posterior scalene here on two. We can see middle here. And then, of course, we've got serratus anterior, right? sort of here, a little bit here on as well on the first. Anterior, did I say posterior in the initial slide? Okay. Well, there, yeah, okay. Let's say the scalene or the serratus posterior? Okay, I may have to change that. But don't worry, I'm not probably not getting into that. That'll be next semester into that muscle anyways. Rib 10 articulates only by, with the body of T10, therefore only one facet on its head, the same as one, right? Because remember 10, 11, and 12, we're starting getting into these single facets. So we've got this single articular facet for articulation with the body of 10. And of course, then we can see here the how it sort of comes around and attaches accordingly. And you can see here the two synovial joints here, they represent the articulation with the crest. Ribs 11 and 12, of course, have no neck or tubercle, and then because they don't articulate with the transverse process, they only articulate with the head on the full facets on 11 and 12, remembering that they're more back on the pedicles than they are on the vertebral bodies, okay? And they have a single facet on their head, which of course we've already gone through. We can see here, and I've got the one here. I can pass 12 around. What did I do with 12? I got all these small parts. I don't know where they are. I leave it up there. Yeah, what do I do with it? It's somewhere. I'll find it here in a moment. Okay, remember here we've got, you know, full facet on one with the demi, and then down here we've got a full facet on 10, 11, and 12, working their way back more onto the pedicles where we get that single facet on the heads of 10, 11, and 12. Okay? More, sorry, 11 and 12. Now, there are two facets for articulation with the corresponding TVP and the other for the vertebral articulation. We have to remember that the rib actually sits anteriorly to the transverse process, not posteriorly, so anteriorly. So you've got to think of those TVPs coming out and the rib is anterior to them. From T2 to T9, the costal facets articulate with the demi-facets on the vertebral bodies and the corresponding and the one to the one superior. Therefore, the superior demi-facet articulates with the head of its own rib, as I've already talked about. I'm just reiterating what I talked about earlier. So you can see here in the drawing, it was very similar to what I sort of walked around and showed you. You can see here we've got the articulation here with the head of the rib onto the demi-facet of the vertebra. And you can see here that we have the articulating part of the tubercle here on the rib articulating with the facet that we find on the anterior surface of the transverse process. You can kind of see it over here as well. Any questions on that at all? So let's go around to the front. So that was all the posterior stuff. Now these ribs come around, and I alluded to the fact that there is articulation with ribs to the sternum. So how do they articulate with the sternum? Ribs do not directly articulate with the sternum. They articulate with the sternum via the costal cartilage, okay? So at the end of your ribs, if you have one that I handed out, you'll see a little cup-like feel to the very tip of the rib on the front. So we have to talk about these costal cartilages. They are ossified bars of hyaline cartilage, and they prolong the ribs anteriorly to attach to the sternum, either directly or indirectly. And remember I said the true ribs generally are ribs 1 to 7, and occasionally 8 can find its own attachment as well. So they have their own costal cartilages, whereas ribs 8, 9, and 10 share the costal cartilage amongst themselves to eventually insert into the costal cartilage of 7, which then, of course, directly articulates into the sternum itself. Everybody follow me on that? So you can kind of see it here. Here we go. We've got, you know, here we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. And then 8 is coming up to 7. 9 is coming up to 8. And 10 is coming up to 9. All forming this one large bar of costal cartilage here to insert into the costal cartilage of 7, which then finds itself in the sternum accordingly. Okay? Just the way the body made them. I'm going to talk about those joints in the joint part anyway, so we're going to spend some time on them. But does everybody follow that? So that's how they articulate. So we've got these, and I'm going to spend a little more time on these when we talk about the joints directly. The other thing are intercostal spaces. So of course, when we look at the fact that the ribs are spaced between each other and there's openings there, that opening between ribs is called the intercostal space. And that's somewhat important because there are many surgical interventions and techniques where things are put through the intercostal space, such as needles or vacuum for collapsed lung. They'll put a tube into the intercostal space to suck any air out, which reinflates the lung if the lung gets deflated and so forth. So, and that, remember I showed you the heart from my friend with all the occluded arteries. He had not him, sorry, it's another friend. I have another friend, got mixed up there. He had a bad mitral valve, and he had his mitral valve replaced this summer or spring. And traditionally, they would crack open the front of the chest, stop the heart to replace the valve, and then go at it again. He had a brand new technique where they went in laterally between the intercostal spaces, deflated the lung, and would approach the heart from that perspective. So it's considered non-invasive. Okay. Non-invasive, great. Crack open your ribs, deflate your lung. Pretty invasive in my mind, but whatever. But that's it. Yeah, minimally invasive. Okay, so you can see here, and doesn't that look like baby back ribs and like side ribs and that kind of stuff, right? Just like it. So when you are eating ribs, you are eating the intercostal muscles of the pig. Or if you're like me, you enjoy a nice prime rib, and that meat between the bones and the prime rib, that's the intercostal muscles of the cow. So movement. So of course, the whole purpose of this sort of configuration is allow ribs to move. I haven't gotten into respiratory physiology yet, but I've alluded to this a couple of times in class, and this is called Boyle's Law. Fundamentally, when we breathe, we want the container to get large and small and large and small and large and small. This is how we move gases in and we move gases out, okay? When you're sitting here right now, you're just using your diaphragm to do that, and the fact that your diaphragm is dropping and rising and dropping and rising is making the container larger and smaller and larger and smaller, and you are passively breathing. But when we're exercising and we're a lot more active in our breathing, and these intercostal muscles plus others, they're constantly raising and lowering the ribs to again expand the container larger and smaller and larger and smaller. So this head demi-facet articulation and articular tubercle TVP articulation allow for rib movements to occur, and they're so important because we want ribs to move to breathe properly. So the culmination of the costal facets, the costal cartilages, and the sternal joints allows for greater range of motion when we're inhaling. The anterior posterior dimension increases when the intercostal muscles contract, and movements of the ribs at an axis passing through the neck of the rib causes the anterior part of the rib to rise. So drop your pencils, find a partner, and stand up. Both of you stand. One is therapist, one is patient. You decide who. Okay. Okay. So, therapist, I would like you to place your one hand on their sternal area, of course, with the ladies above breast tissue, please. And then take your back hand and place it on their thoracic spine area. So you got one in the front, one in the back. Okay? So, what I would want you to do in a moment, your patient's going to take a large inhalation, and I want you to get a sense of the movement of the rib cage here, okay? So, patient, big breath in, big breath out. Okay? Get a sense, therapist, of the movements happening here. Big breath in, big breath out. Okay, if you have to look at your hands and see what's going on, that's fine too. One more time, big breath in, big breath out. Okay, patient, turn your back to therapist. Therapist, place your hands laterally on either side of the rib cage under the arm, under the arms in the axillary region. Good. Okay, arms down, clients. Okay, again, big breath in, big breath out. Big breath in, Big breath out. Okay, now get down into ribs 11, 12 area. Same thing. Big breath in. Big breath out. One more time. Big breath in. Big breath out. Now that you patients are hyperventilated, you're going to change partners and you're going to become therapist. Same thing. So, hand on the sternal area, hand in the back. Okay. Up here. Great. Okay. Big breath in. Big breath out. Therapist, please take note of the movement of the rib cage. Again, one more time. Big breath in. Big breath out. Good. Okay. Patients, back to the therapist. Turn your back to the therapist. Therapist, hands on either side, lateral on the rib cage. Lateral all the way out under the armpits, basically. Get up, 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 under the armpits. Up, up, up. Right here. Good. Good. Okay. Okay. Big breath in. Big breath out. Big breath in. Big breath out. Good. Hands down near the 10, 11, 12. Lateral. Get out there. Get out there. Get out there. There we go. Good. Big breath in. Big breath out. One more time. Big breath in. Big breath out. Okay, take a seat. So, did you notice differences in movement between top and bottom? So what way did the top go? Up and out, okay? And the bottom went just out. Generally, top goes up, bottom goes out. So the anterior-posterior dimension increases when the intercostal muscles contract and the movement of the ribs primarily 2 to 6 at an axis passing through the neck of the rib causes the anterior part of the rib to rise. So what you're seeing there, when that rise is occurring, that rise is actually occurring via the articulation between the head of the rib and the articular part of the tubercle on the TVP. Okay? That's where that's occurring, the majority of it. Because those costal cartilages are kind of firmly in there, right, to some degree. This is called the pump handle movement. So what you were witnessing on the superior aspect was the pump handle movement. Now, transverse dimensions can also increase as a result of intercostal muscle contraction. On the lower part, when you saw the expansion outward, that is known as a bucket handle movement. So the top part was pump handle, and the bottom was bucket. So, pump, for those who are not familiar with a mechanical manual pump, how does that work? Probably nobody's ever seen them anymore, right? Okay, you got a pump that comes out of the water, and you got a handle, and you go, right? So the upper part is doing this. The bucket handle, think of a handle on a bucket that's coming up like this to the top of the bucket. It's going like this. So the top part of the rib cage is going up and down like a pump handle, and the bottom part of the rib cage is expanding outwards like the handle on a bucket. Okay, everybody understand? Right, so you can see it here. Right, so we can see lateral view of the first and seventh ribs in position showing the movements of the sternum and the ribs. Ordinary expiration is A, so just not much, because it's mostly the diaphragm that's moving up and down, which allows us to breathe. And then quiet inspiration is B, sort of moving a little bit anteriorly, and then deep inspiration, we see how much movement we have here. So anything that's going to cause lack of movement of the rib cage is going to result in poor breathing. So individuals like those with emphysema, their chest wall expands and expands and expands in relationship to the inability to breathe properly until eventually the rib cage can't expand any longer. And it's a very unfortunate thing to watch someone in end-stage emphysema because they basically suffocate, because they can't open and close the rib cage any longer big enough to exchange gases. So they literally suffocate in bed. The other thing, too, that always makes me laugh, you know, you watch the Westerns, the spaghetti Westerns or whatever, and the bad guy gets caught and they dig a pit in the desert and they throw you in and they cover you with soil up to your neck and leave you there for the scorpions to kill you, you know, taxi and that kind of thing. You wouldn't even last 30 seconds. You ever notice when they're doing a workout on the street and they're digging big holes, they bring in these big frames, they drop in? The reason for that is so that there's no collapse. Because if you were digging in a large hole and you had the soil collapse, even to midway up your sternum, you would die. Because you could no longer expand your rib cage to breathe, and you would be unable to breathe and you would die. So that's why they put these big frames in, so that there's no falling in of soil, which results in the death of workers. So landmarks. So we have the cartilaginous costal margins, and this is found when the medial ends of rib 7 to 10 join. So the costal margin, also known as the costal arch, is this V that we have here when we, right? Because you guys have done diaphragm, right? So you follow the costal margin to, right? Because the diaphragm runs and attaches along that costal margin, okay? So we can see it here. Here's your costal angle that's represented by the costal margins. So the costal margins are here, but the width of this is known as the costal angle. There are differences gender-wise in terms of what the angle looks like, but for our purposes, it doesn't really matter a whole lot. But just to understand that, you know, this is what you're palpating along when you're doing that palpation for the diaphragm, is you're moving along these costal margins to find the diaphragm. Okay? All right. I found my 12th rib. So as usual, we've done the bones. Now we need to do the articulations. And this is going to be a bit of review because we've gone through a bit of it already, but there are associated ligaments that we need to go through as well. So, what do you guys have? Let me see who's got their block. Oh, I must have forgotten that. I'm so sorry. Hang on, give me 2 seconds here. You'll get it in a second. You can if you want, sure. It won't even take me 10 minutes, but if you want to take 10, that's fine. We'll take a break later, but just 10. Man, just 10 for a water break. We'll take another break later. There. Okay, let's get back at it. I did upload it, so it is on your blackboard. It is there. Okay. So as I said, we've talked a lot about it, so this is just going to further, a little more in depth in terms of things we talked about with these articulations. So we're going to do the costal vertebral joints first. Of course, we're talking posterior ones. So, of course, the joint of the heads of the ribs, it is a, we're talking, you know, the typical ribs. So the head of each typical rib articulates with demi-facets, a of two adjacent vertebra and the intervertebral disc in between. These are synovial joints, and they are plane synovial joints, of course, therefore gliding and sliding. Now, when we look here, these sliding, gliding joints, we still have the crest to contend with. So the crest, of course, now is facing the intervertebral disc. So there we have a ligament. So we have the two demi-facets on the head that articulate with the demi-facets on the thoracic vertebra. Now the crest of the head has a ligament that attaches the crest to the disc directly. This is called the intra-articular ligament. Okay? So it attaches the crest of the head of the rib to the intervertebral disc. It is located within the joint, and it divides the joint into two separate synovial cavities, which we can kind of see here. So here is the neck and the head, and then, of course, we have the crest here. So here's the superior demi-facet. Here's the inferior demi-facet, and then we have the intra-articular ligament here that is attaching the crest of the head to the disc itself and therefore dividing the joint space into two, a superior joint cavity and an inferior joint cavity. And, of course, being a synovial joint, it's got a joint capsule, it's got hyaline cartilage, it's got synovial membrane, it's got synovial fluid, and so forth. Okay? It's a normal synovial joint. All right? Okay? That the intra-articular ligament divides it into two separate synovial spaces within a singular joint capsule. So please understand that. It's not two separate capsules. It's actually one capsule that surrounds the intra-articular ligament and the two synovial spaces, both superiorly and inferiorly. Does that make sense now? Okay. All right. So how do we stabilize this? How do we provide support to it, right? We have a couple of ligaments. Obviously, we always have ligaments that relate to synovial joints. So the first are called radiate ligaments. Now, radiate ligaments mean they radiate. Okay? They start narrow and they spread out. They radiate outwards. Okay? So they strengthen the joint capsule anteriorly, and it fans out from the anterior margin of the head of the rib, and it spreads all the way to both vertebral bodies. So, like a fan, right? So you can see, actually this picture's a bit better here. You can see how it fans out here. Here's your radiate ligament here. So it's going to start at the head here and spread to get to both vertebral bodies superiorly and inferiorly. Now, there are exceptions to this. The first, 11th, and 12th, and sometimes the 10th, articulate posteriorly only with their own vertebral bodies, not two adjacent ones. So we know 11 and 12 for sure, and the first, right? So rib 1 has its singular facet and a singular facet on vertebral body. And 11 and 12, of course, the same thing. Those two ribs articulate with a single facet on 11 and 12, and occasionally sometimes 10. But we've talked about that quite a lot, actually. Yes. Intervertebral disc. So it's the disc between the vertebral bodies. So because there is this singular articulation between the head of the rib and the vertebra, there is no intraarticular ligament and there is no separation of the joint cavity. It's singular, right? So single rib into a single facet on the vertebra means there's no intraarticular ligament, and it's one singular synovial joint space. Does that make sense? Should make sense, right? Where we have the two demi-facets, we have the separation, but in the single articulation, we just have a single plane synovial joint between that rib and that single facet, correct? Which would be the superior one in the case of one, correct? But in 11 and 12, it's a single one. It's out on the pedicles, if you remember correctly. Okay? So we can see here we've got kind of cut away. So we can see here it's showing the inferior joint cavity. The intraarticular ligament's been removed, and so too the superior vertebra itself above, and we can kind of see down into it. So here is our radiate ligaments here. So again, here's our costal facets here, of course, that articulates here with the tubercle of the rib. So here we can see the synovial cavity here of the demi-facet of this rib off the crest. Well, the intra-articular ligament is right here on this side where it has not been cut away. Here it's been cut away. We can't see it. So again, the superior vertebra has been removed here, but it is showing the superior articular facet. But of course, it's not articulating with a vertebral body because it's been removed here. But we can see the intra-articular ligament here, and here it's been cut away. We can see the inferior synovial cavity. Also here we can see the synovial cavity between the articular tubercle and the transverse process. So that was this again these posterior joints, these costovertebral, sort of the head itself. Now we're going to go a bit more into them. So the costotransverse joint is the next one. So we did the costovertebral, which is the head of the rib with the vertebral bodies. The costotransverse telling you the same thing, articulation between the rib and the transverse process, right? So it's the tubercle of the rib articulates with the costal facet of the corresponding transverse process. Synovial. Same thing, joint capsule, hyaline cartilage, synovial membrane, synovial fluid, right? Only now we're talking about the articular tubercle on the rib and the TVP of its corresponding vertebra. Yes? Okay. What holds this all together? The first is something called the lateral costotransverse. And this ligament passes from the tubercle of the rib to the tip of the TVP. So let's get our mind where we are here. The tubercle to the tip of the TVP is the lateral costotransverse ligament. Everybody see that in your mind? The tubercle of the rib to the tip of the TVP. Okay? The next is the costotransverse, also known as the medial costotransverse. It passes from the posterior surface of the neck of the rib to the anterior surface of the TVP, which is the ligament that fills that space that you saw when I put the two ribs together. Did you notice there was a bit of a space there? Okay. That space is filled in by the costotransverse ligament. It fills that space in. So we can kind of see it right here. So again, the lateral costotransverse here, again, from the rib to the tip of the TVP. And then, of course, we've got the costotransverse ligament here that's filling in the space between the neck and the TVP itself, filling in this area right here. Everybody following me so far? And of course, then we've got the superior costotransverse, and this arises from the crest of the neck of the rib to the transverse process superiorly. So we have radiate ligaments here holding in this costovertebral joint. We then have our lateral costotransverse, which is between the rib and the tip of the TVP. We have our costotransverse, which fills in the space between the neck of the rib and the transverse process. And then we have the superior costotransverse here that is rising from the superior aspect of the neck of the rib up to the TVP superiorly. Well. Kind of make sense? Just understand, we've got the names tell you exactly where they are, and that their whole purpose is to prevent excessive movement of the rib and its relationship to the transverse process and the vertebral bodies themselves, right? So they're kind of in place to prevent excessive movement. Strong ligaments limit movement to slight gliding in ribs 8, 9, and 10, and the articular tubercles on ribs 1 to 6 are convex to fit into concavities. Of the and on the TVPs, therefore, we get superior and inferior glide, which results in slight rotation of the rib. So obviously, the one thing you couldn't feel when you were sort of feeling each other's breathing, there actually is a rotation to the rib that occurs in those movements. But you just feel them on the grander level of us bucket handle and pump handle movement, which is causing this expansion of the thoracic cage. And of course, ribs 11 and 12 have no costal transverse joint at all. So they move quite a bit. And one of the muscles we're going to learn here is called quadratus lumborum, and it's one of the muscles that pulls 11 and 12 down. The thing to remember when we're looking at how the ribs expand in order to create a larger container, superior ribs tend to travel superiorly, inferior ribs tend to travel inferiorly, which makes sense, right? They're kind of somewhat moving away from each other, therefore the container is getting larger. The anterior articulation, so we have to go back to those, you know, where the ribs come around anteriorly, we have the sternocostal joints. Now, the first sternocostal joints is where we find costal cartilage is articulating with the manubrium. So this up, this first rib up in the upper part of there. Remember on the manubrium, we had a groove for the clavicle, but below that, we had a groove for the first rib. So the first rib is considered to be a primary cartilaginous joint, so therefore it is a synchondrosis. Thought you didn't have to worry about those words anymore, didn't you? Okay, it is a synchondrosis. The second to seventh sternal costal joints, of course, we have these costal cartilages that articulate with the sternum at very small synovial joints. Now, if you remember, do you remember the sternum had the little like teeth-like kind of configuration? So each of those indentations is where the costal cartilage of the true ribs, 1 through 7, go into that little groove. The costal cartilage fits in. Remember, the rib does not articulate with the sternum. It comes around to the front, articulates with its costal cartilage, and then the costal cartilage articulates into that groove in the sternum, right? Okay? 2 through 7. If we get a separation of the costal cartilage from the sternum, this is known as a rib dislocation. Okay? The costal cartilage separating from the sternum, not the rib. Okay? Now, of course, because of the small movements here when we need support, we have radiate sternal costal ligaments. So this means that this is a ligament that spreads out, it radiates out. It strengthens the capsules of the second to seventh intercostal joints, and it fans out from the costal cartilage's anterior and posterior surface to anterior and posterior surfaces of the sternum. So you can see here, right, we're looking anteriorly, you can see these radiate ligaments coming from the costal cartilage and spreading out, pretty much covering almost the entire anterior and posterior surfaces of the sternum. Right, sort of holding them in place. Okay, you can see the here's your first rib here. So again, up here you've got your sternoclavicular joint. We're not going to be talking about that at all. But just below it, we see here our first rib here, right, and its articulation in here, and we're saying that it is a synchondrosis primary cartilaginous joint. Down below here now, you can see here are your small synovial joints. And your demi-facets here from 2 through 7. We then have interchondral joints. So this is now we're talking about the articulation of the tip of the rib with that costal cartilage. So this is between, sternocostals? Yeah, sorry, okay. The next are the interchondral joints. Remember how ribs 1 through 7 were true, and then 8, 9, and 10, they all come together to eventually all sort of attach and come into the sternum via the 7th costal cartilage, right? So these, where they all come together, so between 6 and 7, 7 and 8, 8 and 9, and occasionally 9 and 10, right, we have these interchondral joints. Within 6, 7, 7, 8, 8, and 9, they are plain synovial joints that are strengthened by these interchondral ligaments. And between 9 and 10 is usually a fibrous joint. So 6, 7, and 8, and 9 are synovial, where 9 and 10 tends to be fibrous. So we can see here I don't know if they've actually drawn them in here. They were in that one diagram, but they are little synovial joints here, here, and here. You kind of, I was thinking, You can kind of see one done here. They would be right in this area here. The costochondral joints are between the tips of the rib and the costocartilage itself. So the costocartilages fit into cup-shaped depressions at the anterior ends of the ribs. So all of you who have the ribs, if they're still intact, and you put your finger on the very tip of the anterior portion, you'll see there's a bit of a cup there. And that's where it would fit into the costocartilage, into that cup. Not that end, that end. See the cup? Okay. So we have the costocartilages fit into a cup-shaped depression at the anterior ends of the ribs. The periosteum of the rib is continuous with the perichondrium of the costocartilages, so they tend to run along, but we only call it the perichondrium because it's on cartilage, whereas it's the periosteum because it's on the bone of the rib itself. If we get a separation between the costocartilage and the rib, that is called a rib separation. Okay, so dislocation if it's the costocartilage and the sternum, a rib separation if it's between the rib and its costocartilage. If it breaks, it's basically a dislocation. It's a dislocation. But some people do get subluxations. Anybody here had a rib go out? Rib head go out?
Yeah,
sometimes
like chiropractors are like, oh yeah, it's ripped out.
Yep. It's a shift between the head and its demi-facet articulations. So when you're talking about chiropractic adjustments and things that are out, it's not a full dislocation. They call it a subluxation. So the relationship between the two pieces shifts a bit, and it's just slightly out. But the classic sign for a rib subluxation is pain both posteriorly and anteriorly. Because if there's an imbalance of the rib between the rib and the vertebral articulations, then that's going to affect the joints anteriorly as well, because the rib's going to be shifted out. So therefore, the articulation of the rib to the costocartilage then kind of shifts a bit, and then that affects the costocartilage to sternum thing a bit. So the classic symptom of a rib head that's subluxed is pain in the back and pain in the front, especially upon deep inspiration. So most people, when they have an acute subluxed rib head, they can't take a deep breath. It hurts too much. And they'll have pain both in the back and in the front. It's classic. You're going to learn a couple techniques that help with that. Not exactly a chiropractic adjustment, because of course we can't do that, but there is a way to shift rib heads in. Unfortunately, if it's a significant one, it can become a chronic problem for the rest of your life, or even just a cough when you get a cold and, ah, damn, there it goes, right? It can shift that on you. Manubrial sternal joint. So obviously, this is between the manubrium and the sternum. It is a symphysis. So it is articulating surfaces between the manubrium and the upper part of the body of the sternum are covered with hyalin, and they are united by a fibrocartilaginous disc. Clinically represents the junction of the second rib at the sternal angle, which is at this manubrial sternal joint that we find that sternal angle. That's where it exists. It normally moves slightly with respiration, but it can ossify with age. And in 30% of people, the disc can be resorbed, leaving a non-synovial cavity. So like a little bit of a cavity between the manubrium and the sternal body. So you can sort of see it up here between the two. The xiphoid sternal joint is a synchondrosis, primary cartilaginous, usually ossifies after about 40 years and fuses with the sternum, which then becomes a synostosis. So we can see here the manubrial sternal joint here, which represents the sternal angle, and then we can see the xiphoid sternal joint here between the inferior part of the body of the sternum with the proximal aspect of the xiphoid itself. Yes, correct. Same thing. Yes. So, what is the significance of these joints that we've just gone through? Obviously, is to permit movement of the ribs and sternum during respiration. They are continuously moving, right? We're always expanding and contracting the rib cage to some degree. Small if we're sitting like you are now, not doing much, but quite a lot more when we're exercising. Any disorder that reduces movement results in interference with respiration, such as COPD and anxiety states. Excuse me. Okay, muscles. We've done our bones, we've done our joints, now we need to do our muscles. The first is called serratus posterior superior. It rises from the lower portions of the ligamentum nuchae, the spinous processes of C7 to T3, and it goes to the superior borders of the ribs 2 to 5 on the external surface. The reason it's called serratus is because where it has these singular attachments on ribs 2, 3, 4, and 5, it looks like the teeth of a saw. So you can see here this tooth-like configuration of the attachment here. And this hence is the reason why it's called serratus. So we have a serratus posterior superior, a serratus posterior inferior, and a serratus anterior. They're all called serratus because of these small little attachments on each of the ribs gives it that serrated sort of appearance, okay? So again, lower portion of ligamentum nuchae, spinous processes of C7 to T3 to the superior borders of ribs 2 to 5. Therefore, what does this muscle do? Up here, ligamentum nuchae. Down here, superior surfaces of the ribs must. Sorry? No. It does expand the rib cage by doing what? Correct. Elevating ribs 2 through 5. Up here, proximal attachment. Down here, the ribs. So it's a rib elevator, especially on deep inspiration. So elevates the ribs 2 through 5 at the sternocostal and costal spinal joints. Okay? It's reverse action. It does contralaterally rotate C7 to T3, but really, really minor. The big thing about this muscle you need to understand, though, it is a rib elevator. Remember I said superior ribs tend to go up, inferior ribs tend to go down because we're trying to make the container larger. So this is your first muscle. No, it's not your first muscle. It's your third muscle that's a rib elevator. What are the other two? Sorry, it's your fourth. Yes, scalenes elevate ribs 1 and 2 upon forced inspiration. This muscle also elevates ribs, okay? Innervation is intercostal nerves 2 through 5. So remember those intercostal nerves travel through that groove, right? So this is where those nerves come from. So we can see it here, kind of, again, this lower part of the nuchal ligament and so forth coming down to ribs 2 through 5, and it is an elevator. There is no stretch, strengthen, or PNF for it, but it does have trigger points. Does anybody know the muscles rhomboids? Do you have an idea where they kind of are? Almost exactly where this is, correct? But this is far deeper. How do you differentiate the two muscles that are a problem? Trigger point patterns. This produces a deep ache that is felt deep to the scapula, difficulty sleeping on the affected side. It can give a feeling of numbness in the little finger of the ipsilateral hand, or C7 to T3 spinal joint dysfunction, okay? So this is how you may have to determine an issue with this serratus posterior superior or maybe rhomboids, depending on what's happening. Have you guys done fiber direction for palpation in the back? So how the heck are you going to determine what muscle you're on when you're palpating the back? Because we've got a few layers of muscles here, correct? So how are you going to figure that out? Yeah. Okay. Somebody come down. Who's wearing just a t-shirt? I don't want to go through a big sweater or anything. Who's wearing just a t-shirt? Somebody new. Come on. Just real quick. This is really easy. So you can turn your back to them. Okay, so if we think of what we've been talking about muscle-wise, okay, do we have muscles that go this way? Yes. Do we have muscles that go this way? Yes. Do we have muscles that go this way? Yes. Do we have muscles that go this way? Okay, did you learn strumming? Okay, so this, I'm going across fibers, would be, what muscle might I be palpating here? Erectors, because they go up and down. This way, I'm doing fibers. I could be doing rhomboids, or if I want to get here a little bit deeper, serratus posterior superior, right? Okay. If I go this way, a little more superficially, I could be doing mid-trapezius. Yeah. Just, you got to keep in mind, you learn all this stuff, you've got fibers to muscles. Some go this way, some go this way, some go this way, some go that way. So when you're palpating and you strum, you're getting a sense of what direction the fibers are moving, should determine and give you a fairly good determination of what muscle structure you're actually probably palpating. And on top of that, of course, my superficial touch to my deeper touch is going to have a big change as well, correct? So here's your challenge. When you're palpating each other and you're working on each other in your labs, right, close those eyes. Feel those fibers. What direction are they running? And knowing your attachments and where they are, you get a better sense of where they may be, okay? So I want you to, thanks. I want you to start doing that in clinic or in lab so that you're getting a better sense of what the structure is. So this is strumming. It just, I think it's like the strings of a guitar that are running a particular way. You're just strumming across the fibers of each of those muscles as you work your way through, right? So, where was I here? So this would be, you know, one of the things you might do that would represent this muscle and or, you know, the trigger point referral pattern could as well. Serratus posterior inferior. So we had one up here, serratus posterior superior up here at the top. Now we have serratus posterior inferior. So now we're going all the way down. Same idea. Serrated because it attaches to ribs. Spinous processes of T11 to L2 to the inferior borders and external surfaces of ribs 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12 near their angles. So where serratus posterior superior was doing this, what is inferior doing? This. So it's starting here immediately and coming up to the ribs. So therefore, this muscle must do what to the ribs? Pull them down. Right. So superior pulls ribs up that it attaches to, and inferior pulls the ribs down. And if the ribs on the top are going up and the ribs on the down are going ribs on the bottom are going down, what's happening to the container? It's getting bigger. And you breathe in. Okay? So spinous process of T11 to L2, inferior borders and external surfaces of ribs 8 to 12 near the angles. So therefore, it depresses ribs 9, 10, 11, and 12 at the sternal costal and costal spinal joints. It does do some contralateral rotation, but again, I won't ask questions on either of those because that's not that important. To me, the understanding is these. Now, let's talk about these two muscles from a pathological point of view. If a patient has something like COPD, and they're spending hours really inhaling and working these muscles, is it likely they're going to be sore, painful, and maybe have trigger points? Yes. So someone who comes into you and they, you know, upon your observations or your case history, they say, I have COPD or I have emphysema and I got back pain. These might be some muscles you want to spend some time on because they're obviously getting overworked along with scalenes, right? Scalenes are going to be working extra hard too because they're working hard at breathing all the time. So keep that kind of stuff in mind. Innervation, subcostal nerve, intercostal nerves 9, 10, and 11. So we can see it's down here. Okay, so we had superior up here. We have inferior down here, and you can see it pulls the ribs inferiorly upon forced inspiration. And again, serratus, because it has these little serrated edges as it goes out to find attachments on those ribs. Again, no stretch or strengthen to isolate them at all or PNF. In here, you can get an aching pain in the lower posterior rib cage, and because it's tight with trigger points, you may find that ribs or joints 10, 11, or 12 could be not moving very well at all. Okay, so between the ribs. There's muscles between those ribs, and of course, they are small groups that lie in the intercostal space. So because they lie in the intercostal space, they are called intercostal muscles. So let's do the external ones first. They go from the inferior border of one rib to the superior border of the rib directly inferior. From rib down to rib. From rib down to rib. And they're on the external surface. It elevates ribs 2 through 12 at the sternal costal and costal spinal joints. They help contralaterally rotate the trunk of the spinal joints. They can flex, extend, and laterally flex the trunk of the spinal joints, but obviously it's not primary. And of course, because they run in the intercostal space, they are innervated by the intercostal nerve at that level. So obviously there are how many intercostal nerves? 1 and 2, 2 and 3, 3 and 4, 4 and 5, 5 and 6, 6 and 7, 7 and 8, 8 and 9, 9 and 10, 10 to 11, 11 and 12, 11. Okay, so we can see here, right, we've got your inspiration, expiration. So here are our intercostals here, and we can see them here. So you can see here on the external surface, so you're almost directly touching them when you go between the ribs from this perspective, okay? And these do what? They elevate the ribs. So external intercostals elevate the ribs because they're arising from one rib and going down to the other. Now, deep to the external intercostals are the internal intercostals. So just behind them. Internal intercostals arise from the superior border of its costal cartilage of one rib up to the inferior border of the rib and its costal cartilage superior. So external goes from top to bottom. Internals go from bottom to top. Therefore, they depress ribs 1 through 7. So external intercostals elevate and internal intercostals depress. So external up, internals down. And of course, it ipsilaterally rotates the trunk of the spinal joints. Don't worry too much about the flex, extend, and lateral reflex. Innervations, again, are the intercostal nerves at each level where they are. So we can see here deep, kind of coming along in between. So here is our external intercostals sort of here and then internal intercostals here. So that would make sense to say then, you know, depending on what's happening, we could say that external intercostals work on inspiration and internal intercostals work on expiration because they're making the container smaller because they're pulling ribs down. Okay. To stretch them can be like so, whether it's done passively by the therapist or actively by the patients themselves. Trigger points here, basically local pain that spreads anteriorly from the site of the trigger point or to the adjacent intercostal space if more severe. You can get some decreased range of motion, especially on lateral flexion because you're stretching them out a bit. Anybody here found any trigger points in your partner in lab when you get between the ribs? Yeah, they're not uncommon, that's for sure. Next muscle is transversus thoracis. It arises from the inferior two-thirds of the internal surface of the sternum, the xiphoid process, and the costal cartilages of ribs 4, 5, 6, and 7, and goes to the internal surfaces of the costal cartilages 2 through 6. So it looks like this. So on the inside, behind everything, between the sternum and the ribs. Again, internal surface of the sternum, xiphoid process, and costal cartilages, ribs 4, 5, 6, and 7, to the internal surfaces of the costal cartilages of 2 through 6. So we can sort of see it here in this drawing and sort of here as well. Depresses the ribs 2 through 6 at the sternal costal and spinal costal joints, and it does help elevate the sternum upon inspiration. And it too is innervated by the various intercostal nerves as well. No stretch, strength, or anything there. Now we get to do the diaphragm. Okay, so the diaphragm is the what? Major muscle of respiration, right? It's the one that's working all the time. So it is dome-shaped. So we want to take into account that it's dome-shaped. It is the chief muscle of inspiration. And as we talked about on Monday when I was talking about the heart, the pericardium of the heart lies on the central part of the diaphragm, thus separating it into right and left domes, with normally the right higher than the left. Why? Yeah, the heart's in the way. Because the heart deflects left, the right dome of the diaphragm tends to be a bit higher because there's no heart on the right-hand side, whereas the left dome is not quite as high because the heart sits on top of it. But I want you to get the idea. And there's actually, so I took a course a number of years ago, and it was an osteopathic kind of course. And I saw some diagrams I was quite fascinated by. The diaphragm kind of went like this. And then, of course, the heart kind of sat like that. What it showed on there were actually fascial attachments of the pericardium of the heart actually attaching to the diaphragm. And we do know that when the diaphragm is moving, the heart somewhat shifts position as well. Not a whole lot, but a little bit because of those attachments. So, during aspiration, the right dome reaches as high as the fifth rib and the left dome to the fifth intercostal space. And we kind of talked a little bit about that on Monday. Is it just how high this diaphragm actually gets in the thoracic cage? It's not way down here. It's quite a ways up here on its dome. It runs quite high. Of course, because it is a large muscle and associated tendinous tissue that runs right across the whole thoracic cage, it's kind of a barrier, right? It's this big, thick structure. Well, the problem is stuff needs to get through there. When you eat food and swallow your food, it passes through the diaphragm to get to your stomach. We have an inferior vena cava that needs to bring blood from the lower limbs and get to the heart. And we also have an aorta that needs to take oxygenated blood that's just come out of the heart and send it down to the lower limbs of the body. So we have some holes in it that allow for this to happen. There are three openings. There is two hiatus and one foramen. There is the aortic hiatus, which allows the passage of the diaphragm, of the aorta, sorry. We have the esophageal hiatus, which is where your esophagus passes through to enter into your stomach when you're swallowing food. And then we have the caval foramen, which is where the inferior vena cava passes through to get to the heart. So we can see here, right, we've got a number of things here. So this is for the aorta, okay, down here running along, and you can see your two others here. Now, here we go. Here is the caval foramen here, which would represent this right here in this diagram. Oops, sorry. And then we have the esophageal one here, which is, good Lord, Brian, represented here. And then we have this for the aorta. So we have these three very determined, very specific hiatus or foramen, which allow these structures to pass through. Anybody here heard of reflux? GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disease? That's where people have their food come back up. Well, part of what happens is the esophagus uses the diaphragm as a sphincter. And damage can happen to that part of the esophagus, and part of the stomach can actually, if it gets bad enough, part of the stomach can actually pass up through and get above the diaphragm. What's that? Yeah, known as a hiatus hernia. Some others, though, have damage enough to the, not big enough to have the stomach go through, but no longer can it close off the esophagus. And when they eat food, the material that's getting broken down in the stomach can pass all the way back up into the esophagus, in some cases, all the way to the back of the mouth. It's heartburn with food. So picture that these individuals, they burp after dinner, and they can almost re-chew their food because all these solid material comes all the way back up into the back of their throat. I've lived it. I had it terribly. And I've had a procedure done that's saved my life. Fundoplication, it's called. They wrap the stomach around the esophagus and make a new sphincter. It changed my life. So, but understand that that's where it passes through and it provides some of that. Okay? So the muscular part of the diaphragm lies peripherally and the fibers converge to a central tendon. Here's the problem with the diaphragm. It has bony attachments on its periphery, but there's no bone for it to attach to on the central part. We don't want that anyways because the diaphragm's role, again, is to make the container bigger or the container smaller in relationship to the lungs and the thoracic cage. So centrally, we have a tendon. There are no bony attachments to the central tendon. The central tendon is divided into three leaves. which we can see here. We have the left leaflet, the right leaflet, and the middle leaflet. So you can see it's divided into three distinct tendinous areas here, okay? All known as the central tendon collectively. The muscular sheet of the diaphragm, therefore, is divided into three parts because of the way it sets up. The sternal part is two muscular slips that attach to the xiphoid process on the internal surface. So we have two muscular slips onto the xiphoid process. The costal, it attaches to the internal surface of the inferior six ribs and their costal cartilages. So in other words, it kind of comes all the way around, and this helps form the dome. And the last is the lumbar. It attaches to L1, L2, and L3 from two aponeurotic arches, the medial and lateral arcuate ligaments, two tendons called the right and left crura, and the three superior lumbar vertebra. And those three attachments go to the central tendon of the diaphragm itself. So we've got, here's your right and left crura that we see here coming down, kind of seeing here. And then we have these attachments on these costal portions all the way around that we can see here. And then we have this anterior xiphoid area we find attachment to, all coming together to attach to this central tendon and these three leaflets. So two muscular slips that attach to the xiphoid process, parts of it that attach to the internal surfaces of the inferior six ribs and their costal cartilages, and then two aponeurotic arches, these arcuate ligaments, and two tendons called the right and left crura, all coming, have muscle to attach into the central tendon, which gives us this dome-like configuration. And I'm assuming that when you palpated this in lab, you went along those costal margins and kind of tucked underneath a little bit. Did anybody find bubble wrap? Anybody on their partner get under there and get all crunchy and bubbly? Nobody? You'll come across it. It's just connective tissue stiffness, and it kind of gets crunchy when you get underneath. Okay, so we can see it here upon palpation, and this is where you're palpating, of course, when you're doing it. And you can see here how the heart actually lies and shares some of its fibrous pericardium with this domed part of the central tendon of the diaphragm. It functions, of course, during inspiration and expiration. So the diaphragm, when it contracts, brings the dome down, thus making the container larger, and we breathe in. When the diaphragm relaxes, the dome comes back up, makes the container smaller, and we breathe out. So therefore, its major role is to change the volume of the lungs through expanding and contracting. It's very interesting innervation. Its motor innervation is the phrenic nerve C3 to C5. The nerve that innervates this muscle down here arises from way up here. Okay? C3 to C5. As sensory, the central part of the diaphragm is that phrenic nerve, 3 to 5. But peripherally, it's the intercostal nerves, T5 to T11, and the subcostal nerve of T12. Kind of important. The reason is, during thoracic surgery, you may come across individuals who've had damage done to the phrenic nerve on one side or the other. Saw it quite a number of times in clinical setting in the hospital. So that means that part of the diaphragm doesn't contract properly, and these individuals have respiratory issues of being able to breathe properly. So damage to phrenic nerve can be done quite often, can also be done through radiation therapy, during cancer treatments, that kind of stuff. So please know your phrenic nerve. It's pretty important in its relationship to this muscle. To strengthen it, you can quite literally just put a weight on the belly and do abdominal breathing. That will strengthen the diaphragm. And to stretch it is forced expiration. And get that diaphragm to come up, thus stretching it as we continue to breathe outwards. Okay? Trigger points tend to produce pain upon exertion, such as a deep exhalation, and you also can get this stitch we've all maybe had when we first started working out, that little painful kind of stitch, or it can cause some shortness of breath on the superior anterior ipsilateral chest, and it can also cause a bit of shoulder pain here. So if it was on this side causing some pain around here and up here, you might think it is a It's on the left-hand side, up at the shoulder. What might you think it might be initially? Heart attack. Right. Okay, you can take a break now. I'll see you guys around 20 after. What do we got left? Lumbar vertebra. Right? That pretty much is left. Oh, we got the abs to do. So let's come back a quarter after then. And the two without names are right there. So, Yeah, so the two without names are there. So have a look and see if they're yours. We're going to start with lumbar spine first, please. We're going to get there first. We're doing this first. Okay? Lumbar spine first. Then we're going to come back. Yes. Okay? So, because it's kind of related, so shall we say, to some degree, most get done. So, lumbar spine. Again, this should be fairly straightforward because it represents everything we've talked about already, just those very differences that occur, right? So the vertebra and lumbar spine have the same elements as all the thoracic, but of course they're much more massive in size because of this, you know, this significant amount of weight bearing that the lumbar spine actually does. So obviously they're quite a bit larger, they're big, they're chunky because of all this weight. They have no costal facets, duh, because there's no ribs to articulate with, right? The bodies are said to be kidney shaped. The upper and lower surface of the body has what's called a ring epiphysis. You can kind of see it on here. There's a bit of a ring of cortical bone here on the outside. You can see very much more spongy in the center with a cortical ring here. And, of course, what that does is it just provides a little more strength to the vertebra on its margins or edges. Okay, so a bit of cortical bone here. I'll pass it around and you can kind of see it on there. These surfaces are nearly parallel except on the fifth, where the body is deeper anteriorly than posteriorly. And the reason for that is because we have to maintain this curve. So this is the relationship of L5 and S1, which is the sacrum. And we're not oriented this way when we stand. We're oriented this way with our sacrum. So our sacrum actually sits like this. And then, of course, we have that. What kind of curve is the lumbar spine? We got a lordotic curve here. So therefore, how that lordosis begins is that L5 is larger anteriorly than it is posteriorly, so it's a bit wedge-shaped, which promotes this lordotic curve of the lumbar spine. Okay. The vertebral foramen is triangular in nature, so when we look at it, you know, it's kind of more like a triangle, which we can see here. And spinous processes are rectangular in shape, so they're kind of more flat. And the term it's used is called spatulated. So they almost kind of look like a spatula. They're square, they're quite flat, they're quite large. And the articular processes face laterally and medially. So now we have C-spine is this way, T-spine is this way, and L-spine is this way. Okay, so if we look at the neck, we've got this obliqueness. You're looking in the lateral, you're looking in the sagittal plane here, right? They sit like this. And then in the T-spine, they sit like this. And from the lateral plane, the L-spine sits like this. The articular processes. Okay, they're like this in the C-spine. They're like this in the T-spine. And they're like this in the L-spine. And if they sit like this, what can't you do with the L-spine? Can't rotate. Right? They're going to jam into each other. So there is minimal rotation in the lumbar spine. Does that sound confusing to you? Is that confusing? Why? Because it's where my hands are? Yeah, they do because they face medially and laterally. So if this is anterior and this is posterior and we're on the sagittal plane, okay, C-spine facets articulate like this. Right? The T-spine facets articulate like this, and the L spine processes articulate like this. Okay, if I do it this way, right, you're looking me in the face. C spine goes this way on the angle, right? On the angle. Yeah, okay, to the back. T spine sits straight up and down, and L spine sits like this. No, they're just face each other, medial to lateral. Where's that? So, but if you just look at them, right, you can see they kind of, you can see how they just you can't rotate. They can't rotate. So this is where I have arguments with the staff because they say, why are you doing rotation in the lumbar spine? Because it doesn't rotate. Well, it does a little bit, and it does to some degree, but it's quite minor. Okay. So we can see here how they sort of fit medial to lateral. So therefore, you can see there's no way you can get rotation. It's not going to happen. Right, if I put another one in there, you can see how they're gonna, if I try to rotate, they're gonna jam into each other. You can't rotate in the lumbar spine because of that configuration. You can see it here as well. There's your superior articulating process. See how it faces medially, right? And you see if you put the inferior in that space, you can't rotate. Can you see now how you can't rotate? No, they face in medially here and here. Right, so they're like this. So if I try to rotate, I can't. You can see here, I can't rotate because the way they face in medially. What's that? You don't see that? You don't. Where's that other one that I passed around? Here, can I see that just for a second? Thank you. So I put these two together like so. Okay, they're going to jam in. You can't rotate. They're going to jam. See it now? Right? They can't rotate because of the way they face. Okay, they just jam into each other. You can't get rotation. See back here? Watch. See, they can't rotate. They get in the way because of that configuration, right? Okay. They just can't. They face in too much towards each other. All right. You can see the ring epiphysis here in this diagram as well. That cortical bone around that just provides a little more support to it. There is an accessory process on the dorsal surface of the transverse process, basically on the superior articulating process. So the accessory process is right here, kind of on the articulating process and part of the TVP. You can kind of see it right here. The accessory process is immediately inferior to the rounded mammillary process. Now the mammillary process is here on the articulating process here. So we have the accessory process here, kind of on that transition of TVP to articulating process, and then we have the mammillary process right on the articulating process itself. Both of these processes is where the erector spinae attach. You don't find accessory and mammillary processes on any other vertebra but the lumbar vertebra. And so they provide the attachment for the erector spinae. The fifth is the largest of all movable vertebra. He has very thick, strong transverse processes because the fifth carries all the weight of the upper body, which transfers to the sacrum. And this is why L4, L5, and L5S1 is where we find all kinds of back problems because of the amount of forces that are placed on here. And imagine if you were lifting something heavy and turning. It's not so good. Okay. Wait, you can see there's your accessory process there on that transition sort of off the TVP, and here's your mammillary process here, and this is where your attachment sites are for your erector spinae. Yes, right on the tip of the articular part, yes. In 5% of the population, the L5 vertebra is partly or completely incorporated into the sacrum. This is called sacralization. So 5% means you're likely going to treat somebody who has it. 5%, right? So imagine the sacrum has to fuse, right? The sacrum fuses. Well, occasionally the fusion gets a bit too far and tends to involve the L5 vertebra, which you see here. So again, you have where the disc would be, and you can see there's been a bit of fusion here. So this is L5, but it's kind of been incorporated into the sacrum. And you can see it here as well. Most often than not, they have a bit of back pain. Someone does an X-ray and goes, "Oh, you have sacralization." What's that? A little bit, but not to any extent. Now, in 10% of the population, we have a lack of fusion. So, 5% L5 gets fused. In 10% of the population, the first sacral vertebra is more or less separated from the sacrum, and this is known as lumbarization. So you end up with this non-fusion to some degree of S1 to the sacrum. So you end up with an extra vertebra to some degree. Okay, you can see it here. Right, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and that should be the sacrum. And it's not, it's an extra vertebra. So again, pathologically, maybe a little bit of excessive movement. Again, back pain, they take an X-ray and go, "Oh, you got an extra lumbar vertebra." Okay. From a treatment perspective, still, diminishing pain, get them strong in the core. It's the only thing you can do. Now, ligaments. So we've got an articulation between the lumbar vertebra and the sacrum, right? So we have to sort of attach them together. This L5 is down here with the disc, but we also want to support this articulation between L5 and S1. So they're strong bands of connective tissue, these ligaments. They do stabilize the lumbosacral spine on the pelvis, and of course, they are very crucial in supporting the lower lumbar spine. They join L4 and L5 to the iliac bone crest on the posterior pelvis. In other words, when I do this, I can get it here. We'll do this over here. Sorry. So we've got the two pieces here. So we've got the ilium here, the pelvis, and the lumbar spine. These are ligaments that are going to go across from L4, L5 onto the iliac crest. Okay? So from L4, L5 onto the iliac crest. These are known as lumbosacral ligaments. The first is called the iliolumbar ligament. It unites the ilia and the L5 vertebra. It originates from the tip of the L5 transverse process to an anterior and posterior band. The anterior band inserts into the anterior portion of the iliac tuberosity, and the posterior band inserts on the anterior margin and apex of the iliac crest. And you guys know where the iliac tuberosity and the iliac crest is, yes? Okay, so right here. Here's your iliolumbar ligament right here. Okay, so there's your iliac crest, and there's your iliac tuberosity. So we have it goes posteriorly and anteriorly and runs from the TVP across to the iliac crest. So from L5 to the ilium or the pelvic bone. We can see it right here. The iliolumbar ligament is right here. And what's this right here? The ALL, correct. Okay? All right, that's lumbar. Da-da-da. That was so difficult, was it? The hard part's almost over, guys. The whole course. Okay. Abdomen. So, there are five muscles in the abdominal wall, and the best way to remember them is that thing right there on the bottom right. What's that? Yes, our abdominal muscles look exactly like that. We have muscles that go across transversely, muscles that are vertically up and down, and oblique muscles that go from top down and bottom up. Looks exactly like a Union Jack. So there are five. There are three flat. The three flat muscles are the external oblique, the internal oblique, and the transversus abdominal. And there are two vertical muscles, one of which you've probably never heard of before, is rectus abdominis and pyramidalis. Okay, so that right there. And if for the life of me, you all have this, right? Everybody has this. It's just that what lies between the skin and this that can make it hide a little bit sometimes or not. But we all have it. The thing that drives me crazy is this. I don't understand how this became an aesthetic that everybody wants to strive for. To have an app like this, unless you're genetically predisposed to it, you need a fat content of about 1% or less to really show up. What's that? What's that? Yeah, below 10 on even getting 5 down. 1 to 2%. This is why, you know, bodybuilders, they dehydrate themselves, get their body fat down in their preparation for competition. Yeah. But because it's an aesthetic to achieve, most people can't. And therefore, it's like a guy I studied with in massage school, he would only date women that had a stomach like that. I'm like, dude. Right? I thought it was kind of weird. I just think it's a wrong aesthetic for people to think that it's so important. And by the way, it's not a 6-pack, it's actually an 8-pack. So, here's the key. All three flat muscles, remember the flat muscles were the external, internal obliques, and transversus, all three attach anteriorly to a strong, large aponeurosis, which then attaches to a line of tendinous tissue that runs right down the center, and your belly button sits right in it. That line of tendinous tissue right down the mid-sagittal plane is called the linea alba, the white line. Okay, and your umbilicus sits right in it. Okay, so this large aponeurosis, these muscles go into, the aponeurosis covers here and then attaches onto this central tendon, the linea alba at the center. Okay, the linea alba along with the bilateral aponeuroses of the flat muscles forms the rectus sheath. So it forms a sheath, and within the sheath lies rectus abdominis. Within the rectus sheath are found the vertical muscles. So we can see here, you know, we've got our flat muscles here. Here's the linea alba running right down the mid-sagittal line. And then we've got our flat muscles here. And then we have an aponeurosis that runs off the tip of each of those muscles. So your transversus abdominis, your external and internal obliques, they all come together and form a thick connective tissue package from both sides, and within that package runs the vertical muscle, rectus abdominis. So when we look here, here we've got your external oblique, your internal oblique, and your transversus. What I'm trying to get at is this six-pack that everybody strives for actually runs under a very thick aponeurosis where all these muscles come together. So if we were to do a dissection and cut it open, I can't remember if I have one here. If we were to do a dissection and cut it open, you wouldn't even see the rectus group. You would see a shiny silver connective tissue package that the rectus sits in. So that means that the rectus abdominis, the six-pack, both behind it and in front of it, is packaged in a connective tissue package created by the tips of all the flat muscles as they come together. Yes? You very rarely get one in the front because of this package. They tend to be more lateral outside of it where the muscles are coming in towards the aponeurosis. If you think about it, they're usually down here inguinally or out here more laterally. You don't see them right down the center here too often because there's so much connective tissue to get through. They split apart. So you get a splitting apart of the soft tissue, and then the organs can kind of slip out. Yes. Okay. Does everybody make sense to everybody? You got these pieces that come across. So again, you can kind of see it here. Sorry, let's go back to this one's easier. You can see it here where you've got the central verticals here, and then all this connective tissue coming off of the tips of the flat muscles, and then the rectus lie deep within. And again, here in the diagram, it's been semi-cut away so you can see what's happening. So, you know, their rectus group are kind of in there, and you can see there's the umbilicus right there lying right within the linea alba. Okay? Does that make sense? Kind of everybody? So, Rectus sheath is an incomplete fibrous compartment formed by the decussation, meaning the crisscrossing, and interweaving of the aponeuroses of the flat abdominal muscle. There are three layers to the sheath. The anterior layer is made up of the external oblique and the anterior lamina of the internal oblique. The posterior layer is made up of the oblique aponeurosis and the transverse abdominal aponeurosis. So just saying how each of those muscles contributes to this rectus sheath, right? So anteriorly from external oblique and part of the internal oblique, behind the rectus group, the posterior is made up of the internal oblique and the transverse abdominal. There's also a line here called the arcuate line or a crescentic line. This is a border between the superior three quarters of the posterior wall of the sheath and the inferior one quarter. Where this comes in handy is for surgery. They sort of use this as a landmark as to how they approach certain abdominal organs and so forth. Okay, so you can kind of see it here, either above or don't worry too much about the arcuate line, but do know what kind of contributes to the sheath. And you can kind of see them there. So, external oblique. It arises from the anterior iliac crest, the pubic crest, and the tubercle of the pubic bone, and the abdominal aponeurosis to the inferior borders of ribs 5 through 12. So sort of all this area here up to ribs 5 through 12. It flexes the trunk at the spinal joints when it's working bilaterally. It laterally flexes the trunk at the spinal joints when working unilaterally, because we have to remember we have a right one and a left one. It is a contralateral rotator when working unilaterally as well, which makes sense, right, because the way it's coming across. And it depresses the rib cage because it attaches to the rib superiorly. Reverse motor action. It posteriorly tilts the pelvis at the lumbosacral joint and flexes the lower trunk relative to the upper. In other words, it does this and this, reversely. Okay. Innervation, intercostal nerves, ventral rami of T7 to T12. So we can see here, right, coming from the midline to some degree up into the ribs itself. Internal obliques, lateral two-thirds of the inguinal ligament, which runs sort of here in the groin, right, from the pubic bone up towards the pelvis. Iliac crest and the thoracolumbar fascia, all the way around here to the thoracolumbar fascia, okay? And it runs to the lower three ribs, 10 to 12, in the abdominal palmurosis. Same thing. Flexes the trunk of the spinal joints bilaterally. Laterally flexes the trunk of the spinal joints, but this muscle ipsilaterally rotates because of its configuration, where it's coming from, right? Compresses the abdominal pelvic cavity and depresses the rib cage. Intercostal nerves, ventral rami of T7 to L1. So we can see here how it's coming back to forward, hence ipsilateral, whereas external oblique is coming forward to back, hence contralateral. Okay? We can see here for stretching it, anything like this, whether the therapist is doing it or the patient can do it themselves. Trigger points here, pain in the chest, if they're superior trigger points, abdomen, pelvis, and groin in the inferior. It can cause visceral symptoms. Heartburn, indigestion, ladies, abdominal cramping, which you might think is premenstrual cramping, and nausea. Transversus, lateral two-thirds of the inguinal ligament, costal cartilage of the ribs 7 through 12, iliac crest, and the thoracolumbar fascia to the linea alba of the abdominal aponeuroses. And it compresses the abdominal pelvic cavity. The intercostal nerves, ventral rami, T7 to L1, same stretch for the obliques. So we now have a muscle that goes this way. We have a muscle that goes this way. And we have a muscle that goes this way. Right? What we have left now, and I like this picture because it shows the sheath that's been created, and you can see the vertical rectus there in it. Again, pain here produces along the costal margins throughout the abdominal region. Really difficult to separate it from the obliques in terms of it. Our first vertical one is rectus abdominis. You all know it's a six-pack. pubic symphysis to the pubic crest to the xiphoid process and the costal cartilages, 5 through 7. So it's coming between the pubic bone and the costal cartilages. It flexes the trunk of the spinal joints when working bilaterally. Laterally flexes the trunk of the spinal joints unilaterally, and like the others, it does help compress the abdominal pelvic cavity and depress the rib cage. Reverse action, it too is a posterior tilter at the pelvis and flexes the lower trunk relative to it. So again, it pulls the pelvis up this way, causing posterior drop here, or it pulls the rib cage down closer to the pubic bone. Yes. Lateral flexion. So this one will pull this way. Yes, when to work in one side. What? Talk to me later. It's a wholly different question. Innervation, intercostal nerves, ventral rami of T5 to T12. So you can see it kind of running up here. Last one in this group. Oh, and this is the stretch for it, whether it's the patient doing it themselves or the therapist. Trigger points here, over the lower aspect of the heart, diffuse abdominal discomfort and visceral symptoms, heartburn, indigestion, abdominal cramping, nausea, and some suggestions by Travel, diarrhea or vomiting with a trigger point in this area. Last one, pyramidalis. Absent 20% of the people, it's small, triangular. It runs anterior to the inferior part of the rectus abdominis, so it's way down here, just a little tiny triangular muscle down here. Attaches from the linea alba to the anterior surface of the pubis and the anterior pubic ligament. Basically, it tenses the linea alba to help provide strength. Innervation is T12 to L2. So it's a little tiny triangular part here at the bottom of rectus that you can see right here. Trigger points here, basically pubic crest up towards the navel. And the testing here, I had changed the page, but it is on there. I would highly recommend having a read of it. It's a number of pages long, but it's quite informative in terms of how we do exercises to strengthen these muscles and how many people do them inappropriately or wrongly. Muscle testing. Do I have another one to do? Oh, yeah. SI joint, sacrum. So we'll do the sacrum next week. I guess we'll have to. Oh, QL. Right. This is the big muscle you hear about in massage therapy. Every therapist always talks about quadratus lumborum. Have you guys palpated it? Yeah, okay. It's considered a posterior abdominal muscle, but because of its exposure on the back, this is why we do it there. It is a square muscle in the lumbar region, hence its name, quadratus lumborum. Palpated, I like it from the posterior lateral portion, so you can palpate it here from the lateral aspect, but ultimately it sits very, very deep here in the deep abdominal region in this area. We can see it here in its attachments, right? So, medial one half of the inferior border of the 12th rib and the TVPs of L1 to L4, 1, 2, 3, and 4, each TVP, and it runs to the posterior medial iliac crest and the iliolumbar ligament. So what's it do? It elevates the ipsilateral pelvis at the lumbosacral joint. So this, it lifts it unilaterally like so, okay, and anteriorly tilts the pelvis. So it pulls the pelvis up this way, right? Reverse motor action, it can laterally flex the trunk, and you're going to learn that in your stretch or test. Depresses the 12th rib because it attaches up on the 12th, so it's pulling the 12th rib down and extends the trunk at the spinal joints. Lumbar plexus, T12, L1, L2, L3. Like, does everybody have to be somewhere? Okay. Now, the only thing I want to show you here is the lumbar plexus. So I said it's the lumbar plexus. This is a bunch of nerves that comes out of the lumbar area that serves this muscle here. You know what I might do? I think I'm going to do a screencast of the SI joint because we really need to move forward in content. We are so far behind. So I'm going to do a screencast. So next week we will start. It's already in Blackboard, stretching, strengthening, and aerobics and that kind of stuff. And then after that, we do muscle physiology. Everything up to where I just finished right now. I'm going to try to get it done. Yes, I'll let you know once I get it finished. Okay? It's a very small lecture. It's not huge. I think so, yeah. I think it will be. I'll do it this afternoon. Because it's really small. It's not very big.
Test next week.
Yep.